I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss caring for a child diagnosed with a life-limiting illness or injury. There are issues around treatment options, insurance and finances, school accommodations, plus the emotional and physical well-being of the entire family. How do people cope and what are some of the supports and services available? Joining us is Russ Lemke. He's lost his 18-year-old daughter to cancer. He's written a book about his daughter and his experience parenting through her illness titled If I Could, I Would, an inspiring story of a young girl who lived life to the fullest. Russ, welcome. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Mindy.
Also with us is Lindsay Koh. She's a pediatric palliative service manager through Hope Health. Welcome, Lindsay, to you
Thank
as well.
Thank you.
All right, so Russ, it's been over 30 years since your 18-year-old daughter, Stephanie, died from cancer, but tell us a little bit about her.
Well, I would say in brief, she was a character. She was born with a very rare disease of the eyes, which caused her to be blind at 10 weeks. And we were able to recover some of that sight thanks to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. But she did. She was legally blind, but she went on to do some rather amazing things and really had a way of living life to the fullest, even when the cancer returned at 15 and ultimately she died. Gave up by her own choice at 19. So she was a fun person to be around and really had a joie de vivre.
Yeah, she was quite an accomplished equestrian as well, which you, with limited sight you would think would be very difficult to do.
I couldn't quite figure out how she did it, but she somehow was able, because she had such limited vision, but she was somehow able to envision the track that she had, the course she had to follow. And we could see her pointing her whip, which she never used on the horse, whip around and memorizing the places that she had to go on the course. And she was able to do it. And she had no end of ribbons. If you read the book, you can see the horse was laden down with ribbons. So it was really, and it was very much a part of her life.
Yeah. Now, she was diagnosed at just 6 weeks old. Tell us what type of cancer and what first alerted you that something might be wrong.
Well, it's a very rare form of cancer. It's called retinoblastoma. And it's a cancer that grows out of the retina and covers the macula, which is the very small pinpoint of distinct vision. And so it was congenital. We didn't see it at birth. At 6 weeks, the pediatrician checked and didn't find anything. But then we began to see what I thought was a reflection from the ceiling when I was feeding her bottle by bottle. It looked like a reflection. And we noticed her eyes moving from side to side. The reason they were moving from side to side was that she was trying to see around the tumor. Mm. And so we noticed this and took her to an ophthalmologist who immediately that same day referred us to a specialist in Rochester, New York. And then a few days later, we were referred to the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital on 168th Street in New York, which was and I think perhaps still is the preeminent treatment center for retinoblastoma. It's mm-hmm. so rare. There's only one in about 30 or 50,000 people get it. Ironically, it appears to me that the treatment regimen hasn't changed that much since she was a baby. And that's understandable, because if you're trying to treat a disease, what you want to do is treat the greatest number of people possible. So with one in 50,000, it has a little difficulty getting traction.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's what happened, Mindy.
So you had 6 days between the diagnosis and when you could see the specialist, and you thought you could see her condition worsening in that short time. And you write, in retrospect, I wonder if we should have simply presented ourselves in New York on Monday morning. At least we would have been doing something. Doing nothing, you're in for a terrible guilt trip. Guilt, the gift that keeps on giving. So how did you keep yourself from going down that road?
Well, we just occupied ourselves. I'm not even sure how we did it, and it was painful. Hmm. And, you know, in retrospect, maybe we should have just gotten the car and driven to New York. We just moved to the States, the country was a little new to us and so on, so we were a little reticent just to drive down to New York City. But we just kept ourselves occupied. I went to work. We were around friends we developed a great friendship very quickly, wonderful community, mm-hmm. and that just kept us going.
Lindsay, this is probably a common experience for parents whose child contracts an illness or gets an injury, and you second guess yourself, what if?
Exactly. Yeah. It's the guilt, you know, and for kids who cannot speak for themselves. I mean, fortunately, Stephanie could. But there are plenty of kids that they're nonverbal, and or sometimes they can't even hear. And so really the parent is speaking for them. And so they're trying to figure out as best as they can, what would my child want, mm-hmm. you know? And obviously it can happen at a very young age, or as they get older, if they speak for themselves, it's a little easier. But they're constantly in that battle, you know?
And you, of course, everybody wants the best for their child. And it's got to be incredibly frustrating if you're trying to guess what that is, what they need. And then you also have that guilt of you know, am I doing everything I could be doing? You know, mm-hmm. you've got your mind, I imagine, is constantly racing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've never met more of an expert on a disease than the parents mm-hmm. of
right.
a child.
They learn everything.
They learn everything. I mean, you can't Google enough on an illness. I mean, you talk to the parents because that's how they help gain control over it, is by learning as much about the disease as they can.
Right. And of course, Google wasn't around, Russ, when you were going through this. Now, before the treatment to the tumors had caused Stephanie to lose her vision, once the eye with the most serious tumor was removed and she received radiation treatments, all but one of the tumors disappeared and her vision did slowly return. She didn't get complete vision, but what was her prognosis after the surgery and radiation?
Well, the prognosis was that she would live. They were quite sure that they had caught it early enough, and removal of one eye, which was and is the regimen, resulted in being able to treat the other eye with radiation. She didn't require chemotherapy because they felt that it hadn't matured that much that chemotherapy was required. Their prognosis was she'll live, and we can come back to mm-hmm, that yeah. next story mm-hmm. later. She'll live, and she will have some useful vision. And we didn't know what that meant. And so that was the trial and error process of trying to determine how much vision she really had and what she would be able to accomplish with that vision. And, of course, parallel to that is what chances should we as a parent take with this daughter so that she doesn't injure or damage the other eye and therefore be completely blind. Mm. And that's a work in progress.
Yeah. Now, you write that when you were at the Columbia Eye Institute that you stayed with other families in a group home who were undergoing similar experiences. You found this connection with others very helpful. So tell us how that helped you.
Well, it was, because here we were in the unknown. Not only were we in a different country, we were in a different city, which we had never visited before, and we were dealing with an illness we didn't even understand. So to be around people who were going through it and had gone through it was so comforting, because they were like another support group. Mm-hmm. And just being able to compare notes with them gave us, at the start, when we weren't even sure she was going to live or not, the fact that there were people there whose child was still alive, who was under treatment, was encouraging to us. So that support group was invaluable. Mm-hmm. Now, with any support group, there's always perhaps someone who isn't as helpful, and so we tried to steer clear of those people. But by and large, the 95% were mm-hmm. wonderful.
So, Lindsay, being able to talk with others about shared experiences is a really great experience.
Well,
yeah, and even if it's an informal situation, so tell us what you encourage families that you work with to do, because not every family can actually attend a support group.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, for the reasons that Russ probably knows, that you are really homebound, you know, taking care of your child sometimes, you know, and oftentimes you're up in the middle of the night with either worry or because your child isn't sleeping, so therefore you're not sleeping. So what do parents do? We always recommend families go to the Courageous Parents Network. It's a wonderful online group. It's 24/7, and it helps connect families who have similar stories, of course, of what they're going through. It has experts on pediatric palliative care. It covers a wide range of topics. And I always tell families, you know, log in. You know, you can do it at any time. It helps you feel connected. These are Massachusetts families, too. A lot of these interviews are done right out of Children's Hospital. So it makes them feel really connected and supported, you know, something that you just simply can't get with, you know, a one-on-one therapist, for mm-hmm. example. You know, there's something so bonding about speaking to another family that either it's the same illness or something at least similar.
Yeah. And then, of course, there are support groups as well, right?
Sure. Yeah. And depending on the nature of the illness, a lot of times families, you know, it's not just about a child with a terminal illness, because so many will say, well, I feel like I need to talk to somebody who knows my child's illness. Mm-hmm. You know, cancer is very different than neurodegenerative diseases or congenital diseases. So that's a beautiful part about the Courageous Parents Networks, is you can actually sometimes pinpoint, you know, these little podcasts or videos based on specific illnesses.
Because and Russ, you can speak to this. You feel kind of like very isolated and alone, like you're sort of the only ones going through this in the beginning, right? It's like, how can anybody else understand what I'm going through? And when you find someone who does have that experience, it's important, because you have that connection, right?
Oh, it was invaluable. It helped us so much. And we continued with that support group. And as Stephanie improved, of course, we had to go to New York less and less. After a couple of years, we were only going maybe every 6 months. But we still stayed in touch. And that place where we stayed was actually a early Ronald McDonald.
Was that right?
It was before Ronald McDonald's ever started. And thanks to these specialists who were treating exactly retinoblastoma, that was their specialty.
Yeah.
They combined their resources and bought this brownstone on 168th Street, which gave us not only inexpensive housing, but a common living point where we could discuss with each other and have a better understanding of what our needs and frustrations were.
Yeah. And you mentioned that after Stephanie was cancer-free, she had these challenges with her vision, and you knew that there would be a lot of care involved for the rest of her life. In the book, you describe how you and your wife were faced with protecting her physically from the dangers associated with being visually impaired, but also allowing her the freedom to pursue the things that she wanted to do. So how did you find that balance?
I don't know. It was touch and go. It was experiential every day. It was just a constant process of determining the right balance between being overprotective and causing damage to her remaining eye and blindness. Mm-hmm. So it was literally, Mindy, a day by day questioning and reaffirming, confirming, denying, and I can't.
Yeah,
I don't know what the formula was.
The other difficult aspect for a child with a life-limiting illness or injury is being different from others. There's teasing, bullying, and also feeling a bit left out or ostracized from a group. How did Stephanie handle these situations, and how did you as parents help her with that?
Well, we gave her positive reinforcement every way we could. Her so-called plastic eye became her special eye. And for the most part, that was helpful. We reaffirmed her and did things with her which she could do constantly and with her sister. And we took her to places where her lack of vision was less important than perhaps some other places. So we constantly worked on finding those venues and those activities which she could do and feel comfortable with. Mm. In terms of protecting her for bullying, I wish I knew a formula to do that, because as soon as these kids start to school and somebody's different, then that makes them different. It was difficult in New Jersey, more so than when we returned to upstate New York, where we had lived and we had a circle of friends, and they gave Stephanie a lot of support and protection.
Right.
But New Jersey was difficult.
Yeah. Lindsay, how do you help families navigate that?
Well, fortunately, there are so many resources compared to probably many years ago that, you know, children, they can go to collaborative schools. There are times, though, that they go to public schools, but they have an IEP or a 504 plan that really help them with whether it's an academic need or more of a social need. School adjustment counselors. Our program has something called Child Life Specialists, and they really work with kids who are dealing with issues that, you know, Stephanie had, which was, living sometimes half your life in a hospital mm-hmm. and then coming home and then going to school. And I mean, there's no normal mm-hmm. for a child with, any type of illness. So fortunately, I mean, it's definitely a case by case scenario. But, between counselors that are either in the school within our own program, we work with the family to make sure that their specific needs are met. And it is a challenge. I mean, I'm here to validate it that, kids are really troubling.
I'd like to add to that, Mindy, that we have to understand there's a time frame here. We're now talking about 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, in that location, in upstate New York, there just wasn't the infrastructure. When we moved to Toronto, we almost stumbled upon a wonderful system of assistance with specialized care and assistance, in-classroom assistance for kids so that they could mainstream. It was not quite as good in New Jersey. But now we have to fast forward
right.
because we're in a different place now.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's a wonderful thing that we have these systems for underprivileged kids, challenged kids who can mainstream and be part of it. We even wondered if we should send Stephanie to a school for the blind in Morristown, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Thank God we didn't do that because yeah. She had the capacity. She just needed support structure.
Yeah. And she mentioned we didn't have IEPs back then either, and IEPs in case are individual education plans. So we've come a long way since
that. Exactly.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about caring for a child diagnosed with a life-limiting illness or injury. Russ Lemke is with us. He lost his 19-year-old daughter to cancer and has written a book, If I Could, I Would, an inspiring story of a young girl who lived life to the fullest. Also in studio with us is Lindsay Coe. She is the Pediatric Palliative Service Manager through Hope Health. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So as we mentioned, Stephanie was going through this in the 70s and 80s, and a lot has changed since then. But you write in the book that counseling services were offered to Stephanie, but she didn't find them useful. So counseling, I guess, isn't for everyone, and also speaks to the fact that finding the right counselor for a patient is really important. Tell us about her experience with counseling.
Well, I want to be sure that I'm not going to condemn counselors.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie was a unique kind of person, and she had, I've now learned from writing the book, well, transcribing her notes, that she was mature far beyond her years. And I think she had that maturity and comprehension that she, to the point that I don't think that she really needed counseling very much. And we combined that with a few cases, more than a few, every time for me, but I would say my former wife would disagree with this mm-hmm. because she spent more time with Stephanie and she didn't experience that. I did. And so the counselors weren't helpful to her because they would constantly ask, how do you feel about that? And a friend of hers gave her a hat with the letters Heidi Fat on it. How do you feel about that? Because Stephanie had no time for this
mm-hmm.
because she was her own person. She had her own strength. So my caution there, I've written in a book 12 lessons or learnings or suggestions, thoughts. I'm not in any way suggesting not to use counselors, but to be aware mm-hmm. of your child's needs, the counselor's capability, how they work together, does the chemistry work, and not just assume that every counselor can be helpful or that every counselor cannot. It's more
right.
like a caution.
Absolutely. Lindsay, your thoughts on that?
And I can't speak for the particular counselors that Russ and your Stephanie worked with, but, working with teens myself, that traditional therapy, talk therapy really doesn't work. asking how, it's that old mantra, how do you feel? How does that make you feel? But meeting them, of course, where they're at. And second is, teens don't respond to just talking. They respond, to their own medium of of interacting, which is, you know, coloring and journaling and listening to music. I mean, now it's, you know, everything is their phone. But, you know, if I were the social worker at the time, I probably wouldn't have taken that approach personally, you know, that the that social worker did. But, you know, really meeting her where she's at and finding out what her natural interests are, if it was, which it seemed like writing was, or if, you know, the coloring mandalas these days, you know, that you see in the grocery store. Really, it's about letting them dictate how a session would go, so to speak. And, you know, there are so many resources out there now. And, you know, as far as what our program provides, you know, we also help with having conversation, difficult conversations, advanced care planning. And, you know, we work with a booklet called Voicing My Choices, which is a great booklet that helps children and families understand what the child's needs and wants are, you know, what.
And you should mention there are different therapy programs available through PDPAL. Tell us what that is.
It's the organization I work for, and it's a pediatric palliative care network. It is grant funded by the state of Massachusetts, and really it helps serve the unmet needs of children and families with life limiting illnesses. It addresses spiritual needs, emotional needs, physical needs. We provide complementary therapies, such as music, massage therapy, child life specialty. We have spiritual counselors. We have volunteers, pet therapy. I mean, a whole range of services that really it's about enhancing the comfort and quality of the life of the child and family, including siblings. Yeah.
And who's eligible?
Those who have a life-limiting illness. There's no restriction on the when the child would die from their disease, but it would be deemed as from the pediatrician or the primary care provider that it is life-limiting.
Mm-hmm. And how do you talk to a child? I mean, I imagine it depends on the age. How much do you tell
sure.
the child?
I mean, I believe in the empowerment perspective, which is asking the child, how much do you want to know? Especially if they can articulate for themselves their own feelings like Stephanie did. So I think that teenagers and children know a lot more than we probably think they do. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's changed, you know, that over the years. So I'm a firm believer. I mean, I just had a family yesterday where we were going over services, and there was nothing better than asking the child, what would you like? Mm-hmm. What type of complementary therapies do you want? And she was able to ask her questions. And, you know, we even asked her, do you have any more questions about what this program is? And she goes, no, I'm all set. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're very frank about it. And again, it's asking the questions. How much do you want to know?
We have an email question from Jennifer. Says, how do I get the services that Lindsay is talking about? And we'll have a link up on our website later on. But go ahead and tell her.
Well, you can go to the MassGov website. And that talks a little bit more about the Pediatric Palliative Care Network. But if you have, there are many programs in the state that have a pediatric palliative care program, 8 of them. But so it depends on where you live. But if you are in the Cape and Island area or the Greater Boston area, you could go to Hope Health Co. Or that's co.org.
And again, that's, like I said, we'll have a link a little bit later on when we put the show up on the website. Russ, and now when Stephanie was younger, the prognosis was she's going to be okay. So you didn't have to have that conversation when she was young. But did she talk a lot about, you know, what happened? I mean, she wanted to know all the details.
Yeah, she wanted to know. We responded to whatever questions she had. And so we told her she had cancer,
we should remember this is the 1970s, and that's very scary.
Very scary, yeah. And so we basically responded to whatever it was she wanted to know. It was difficult to know at the time, but at one point she asked her mother, "I wonder what it would be to have cancer," and her mother said, "Well, you've already had cancer." And we didn't know at the time what the prognosis was for retinoblastoma. Mm-hmm. And so I guess we answered it as
honestly as
we could at the time. But we responded to her questions, yeah. And we didn't hold anything back. With Stephanie, you didn't hold anything yeah. back.
She wouldn't let you. So we mentioned she was a gifted equestrian, and despite her vision impairment, she won many competitions. Do you think riding was a form of therapy for her?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
There's something about the relationship between a kid and a horse, and maybe it's only because I had two daughters, a girl and a horse, that seems to be so special, and that was wonderful therapy for her. She loved all kinds of animals. She had fish and birds and dogs and cats and all that, but that relationship with the horse was so special, and it started when she was like 6 years old. We were in northern Ontario, and she saw this horse, and she said, "I want to steer it."
I want to steer it. Now, later, when the cancer returns and manifests in Stephanie's leg, the doctors urge you to stop her riding. Knowing how important it was to her, what did you do?
She rode.
She rode. There was no question
yeah,
about there that. Was, there,
yeah, we knew because she had, and at that time, it was, I guess, maybe breakthrough therapy. She operation. She had a knee replacement. Mm-hmm. And the doctor said in New York, said, you know, what about riding? She must not ride. Well, this was one of those times when we made a decision with her that she was going to ride.
Yeah.
And it came back that the leg cracked.
Yeah. So tell us about the return of the cancer in the leg.
Well, it's my understanding, it's a prognosis for some, okay, for some, not all, but for some. That the second decade after retinoblastoma, the cancer reappears in the tibia of the opposite leg, of the opposite side mm-hmm. of the body. And that's what happened in her case. When we noticed this difficulty, we called Dr. Robert Ellsworth in New York, and his first question was, remind me which eye, and we told him, and he said, so it's going to be in her right leg. Mm-hmm. And so, again, not for everyone, but there is this evidence that that's what happens. And so it was osteogenic sarcoma in her tibia. Mm-hmm. Of the.
And now she has a younger sister.
Stephanie's she
younger
does.
Sister. So try to balance the needs of a child with chronic illness or injury with the needs of other children. It gets complicated. When you look back at that time, what did you find the most challenging?
It was the balance between, and there are so many guilts here, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a balance between getting the best care you can for the child with the disease and balancing that with the needs of the other child, and it was very difficult. And frankly, I don't have an answer because it was almost day by day, week by week, deciding what to do next.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, I think the person that was impacted was our second daughter, because there were times when we had to be in New York. Now, you could ask the question, should we have gone to New York? Should we have had her treated at Roswell in Buffalo? Who knows?
Right.
And so I think those were the kinds of issues that we had to deal with, and we were winging it, frankly.
Yeah. And Lindsay, your program offers services for the whole family, so tell us how siblings are included.
Well, as I mentioned before, we have complementary therapies, music, massage, child life specialists. And so when we ask a family, you know, what services do you want? I emphasize it's for the family, including the siblings. And we have some of our specialists that go out, actually do their session just for the sibling. So perhaps they'll do one visit with the child, the patient, and then the next time they come out, they'll do a joint visit to promote sibling bonding, because, you know, over time there becomes a level of detachment from the two children because of the disease, and they can't relate to them, whether it's just because of the emotional impact or because, you know, maybe the child's bedbound and mm-hmm. the other kids are playing. So our complementary therapies really try to promote cohesion among the siblings, but also give them that one-on-one attention that it feels good for them to have their own person coming for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, because you can see where they might feel a little left out. You know, there's sibling rivalry, no matter what the health of the family, but it's like, that one's getting all the attention and I'm not getting any attention.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Russ, Stephanie's vision, as we mentioned, in that remaining eye was impaired, and she struggled at school with reading and didn't have the things we have now that would help her with those reading assignments. You know, she's in the main classroom expecting to do the same work as the other kids, and she manages to do really quite well at school, but it took a lot of effort on her part and the assistance from her mother. Describe some of the struggles with her schoolwork.
Well, it was just lack of being able to read normal size print. And so we had her lessons blown up printing. We had friends take notes for her so that she could listen and they would take notes, and then we'd have those expanded. Her mother spent an abnormal amount of time with her, teaching her music with making the notes bigger on a piece of paper. It did help to have various colors of overlay, which were, for whatever reason, were helpful to her. And I'll say that the teachers that she had were outstanding, mm-hmm. because they would work with her not only at school but after school and take her aside and even come home and give her support. But what's coming out of this interview is the progress that this society...
I was going to say, we've come a long way.
The progress that has been made. People say we aren't any better than we were. Nonsense. We're a lot better than we were.
Yeah. And, Lindsay, there's a lot of different things that you can do to help kids that want to continue with their schoolwork.
Absolutely. And I can't emphasize enough the advancement of technology in so many positive ways, including children with retinoblastoma, that, you know, the iPads now, they have these extremely large iPads that they can work with. Our own music therapists have these devices that allow kids to, you know, pick and choose, you know, things on the iPad to listen to. It's that empowerment piece, you know, because they have lost so much power and control in their life. And so it's really developing ways that they feel like they have dignity and control in their life again.
Yeah. Russ, when the cancer does return, Stephanie undergoes many rounds of chemotherapy, which was rough, but she was tough. And as a parent, what helped you cope with seeing her in pain from the cancer and so sick with the chemotherapy? Did her toughness help you get through
yes.
that?
Yes. Yes. She was, she was going to hit whatever it was she was going to hit. She was going to hit it head on. And her strength helped us and gave us the power to encourage her to keep doing whatever it was that she decided to do. Or, well, even before she was of legal age, we were making decisions for her, obviously. Mm-hmm. But her attitude helped us and reinforced us to help reinforce her. And her circle of friends were wonderful. And we went out of our way to provide additional support for her. Whenever we could, we took a trip to Hawaii. We went to England she stopped chemotherapy and we went to England because she wanted to see London, and she loved Trafalgar Square with all their multicolored hair designs and so on. But she helped us, Mindy.
Yeah. Lindsay, is that a common, the child's attitude helps the parent? I mean, sometimes that isn't the case, right?
Sure. You know, and going back to... you know, I do want to make a mention that was one of the things that stood out to me the most in the book was her resiliency with the pain. And, you know, we do have something fortunate in Massachusetts, which is a great healthcare system, and some of the major hospitals, Boston Children's, Mass General, Dana-Farber, they have something called a PAC team, which stands for a Pediatric Advanced Care Team. And they provide an extra layer of support for children who are battling life-limiting illnesses, including symptom management. So that does help some of the families with dealing with these things that are just so unbelievable. I mean, to watch your child in pain.
I mean, that's like your worst nightmare.
I don't think it could be anything worse. But, you know, to speak to your point, Russ, about how that helped you, and I know it helps families. Absolutely. You know, they follow the child's lead.
Mm-hmm. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about caring for a child diagnosed with a life-limiting illness or injury. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is Russ Lemke. He lost his 19-year-old daughter to cancer and has written a book about that experience, If I Could, I Would, an inspiring story of a young girl who lived life to the fullest. Also in studio, Lindsay Koh, who is the pediatric palliative service manager through Hope Health. Russ, Stephanie was a teenager, as I said, and when her cancer did return, she was 15, I think you said.
Yes.
And she was mature enough to make some decisions about her treatment. Were there times you disagreed with her choices, and was it difficult to not try and convince her to consider other options?
No, we were pretty much in concert. Now, at the start, she was following our lead, and we were doing our best to determine what made the most sense, and it became increasingly more difficult as time went on. We never did disagree. Mm. Toward the end of her life, she was the one that decided that enough was enough, although we were, frankly, we were nudging her in that direction because it became more and more obvious to us that we were entering the area of exploratory medicine here. Mm-hmm. And one has to ask oneself, when is enough enough?
Right.
But there was never a point of disagreement. There was one time, and I don't know if we have time to get into the details or not, but there was one time when she decided she was stopping. She was going to stop. She had had enough. And it was just a matter of circumstances that we were out of the room when a physician came in, a doctor came in, and we weren't there. We had stepped out. And obviously there was a bit of pressure put on Stephanie. And when we came back in, she said, "I've decided to go ahead." Mm-hmm. You know, in retrospect, yeah. I wish we had never left that room, mm-hmm. because at that point she was 16, and if she wanted to stop, we would have stopped.
Right.
But that was just a matter of circumstance. Other than that, we were pretty much in concert.
Yeah. Lindsay, in your experience, is there an approximate age where adolescents are old enough or mature enough to start making choices about their treatment, and what sort of guidance do you give parents on that?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's a particular age, because I've seen, you know, kids who are 10 or 11 years old, they speak as if they're 20,
right.
You know, and I think the longer they've had an illness, unfortunately, the wiser they've become because of that, that illness and what they've been through and the decisions they've had to make. But, you know, as far as what we tell families is really open communication about it. You know, don't let it be an elephant in the room that
right.
nobody talks about. Transparency is key, and always just reflecting things for the child and saying, you know, how do you want to manage this? Ask them the questions. And, you know, again, it's great when they can speak for themselves, because, you know, there's a great portion of our population that can't.
Right.
So it does put a lot of pressure on the family. And I mean, sometimes their pain and their, it's all about nonverbal cues. So, I mean, that's another layer of difficulty. But really, as long as they have that open communication, which it sounds like, Russ, you had with Stephanie, that was a gift.
Yeah. Kristen is giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Kristen. Kristen, are you there?
Hi, yes.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Kristen.
Sorry, I lost you for a minute.
Okay, that's okay. Go ahead, Kristen. Kristen, did you have a comment you wanted to make or a question?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, yes, now I've got you. Yes, I grew up with a sister who died at the age of, actually she was 14 months. She was born when I was 9. And that experience was incredibly formative for me at that pivotal point in my own life. And I just remember watching my parents going through it and how much they had to be absent from our lives. She was hospitalized for 60% of that time. Mm-hmm. But also a change happened within me, which was that I couldn't be in the same room as her when she was really happy. And, you know, that it was just sort of this, at some point during that period, I developed this kind of sense of fear of death and this sort of existential futility, this dark cloud that, you know, sort of at that time was really profound and pivotal to who I became as I grew into an adult. I don't know if that summarizes it, but the impact of living with a child who is dying and you know she's dying and you want to love her, but you know, you're watching her go through this excruciating process and your parents as well. And, you know, I'm 50 years old now and it still, in some ways, impacts my life. I still tear up when I talk about it.
Yeah, no, I so, understandably so. Kristen, thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry for your loss. But that's, I would think, a common feeling for kids when you have a sibling you know is going to die. And that's such conflicting emotions.
Absolutely. And it really... it does make you grow up a lot quicker than you really should be, because and I'm so glad to have a call from a sibling, because again, it's this whole other piece of the pie that, you know, it sometimes are unrecognized in families because of their own loss and their own the guilt that they feel sometimes because they want to say, I want attention, I want love, and yet they feel guilty because, you know, they know their sibling is dealing with something so much by far worse. So, I mean, we have so much support from our program that helps that. You know, even on a spiritual level, we have spiritual counselors that can come in and really, you know, deal with those questions. You know, a lot of times it's the first time they're dealing with a death in their family or anticipating it. And so these are things they've never even thought of. You know, what's in the afterlife, things like that.
Right. And the conversations you have as a family, right, about that. I'm going to say, Stephanie was not a difficult child, but you do mention a point when, as any teenager might, she becomes a little bit surly and disrespectful to her parents. Were you apprehensive about disciplining her, given the difficult time she was going through?
Yes.
Yes, no questions.
Like, yes, I was. But in that case, and it was as her illness was progressing, this was in the latter forms, she really wasn't. She was a very, I won't say compliant, Stephanie was not compliant, but she was not a difficult child to deal with. Her tense situation developed quite late in her illness. And I didn't want to discipline her. Mother felt we should, so we did call a counselor, who said everybody has to have limits in their life. She has to understand those limits. And so we established the limits, and she was fine. Well, I won't say fine, but it was corrected.
Yeah. Lindsay, is it common to see children with chronic illnesses or life-limiting injuries, you know, if they act out? What kinds of advice do you give parents on how to handle those behavioral issues? And I would imagine you'd have a tendency to want to give that child anything they want.
Of course. It's a very fine line to walk. I can only imagine. But, you know, I would have honestly said the same thing. You know, as much normalcy, as much structure, treating the child as you would the sibling, if there is a sibling involved. And, you know, of course, there's always going to be those times where you want to spoil them. You want to just give them what they want because you know what they're going through is so awful and terrible. But instilling as much of the same rules in the house, you know, as possible, I think is the best bet.
Yeah. And at some point, Russ, you decide that you want to give Stephanie a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Mm-hmm. And it's an idea that the Make-A-Wish Foundation now tries to offer to as many children as possible. It's such a great thing to be able to have that experience for the family. But so tell us about your experience.
Well, she was attracted to you too. Mm-hmm. Before you two was you two. And so she was preparing for this very difficult cerebral surgery, and I felt a need to help her. So I had gone to the advanced management program at Harvard, and I had met the chair of Irish Gas Board, and I knew that if she could get to U2, this would be a good deal. So I called him, and at the same time I had some contacts with some investment bankers in New York, because that's the field I was operating in. And I called one of them and said, I want Stephanie to see you, meet you too. And I'm not quite sure which one did it, but the next day we got a call from you too in New York saying, come to Dublin, which we did. And we spent an afternoon with all of them. And in the book, there are pictures of Stephanie with Larry Mullins and with The Edge and and Bono sang to her. It was wonderful. We spent a whole afternoon with them. And then a few months later, much later in Stephanie's life, they called and said they wanted to see her. And we flew on American Airlines. They didn't know what was going on, but we got her on the plane. And we weren't sure she could make it without oxygen, but she did. So we went down to Las Cruces, New Mexico, and they asked her to come in. They must have spent a half an hour, an hour with her. And Time Magazine was out there, because they were a front page of Time Magazine the next week. And I'm sitting there talking to the people from Time Magazine. And Stephanie's in there with Bono and Edge and Larry and Adam. It was wonderful.
Great experience.
I just wish there was some way I could get this book to Bono, but I can't find the guy.
Well, maybe somebody can help you out with that, Russ.
Please,
maybe somebody who's listening knows him. I don't know. Lindsay, everyone copes with the death differently. What is your advice to families going through these situations that might find solace in different ways?
Well, you know, when I work with families, everybody, as you said, responds differently. Some people like to talk about it. Some people like to, you know, go to support groups. Some people like to read books. So really, when I meet with families, it's asking them, quite frankly, how do you like to, how will you like to deal with this? You know, do you want to talk about it? Do you want me to come out and visit? Or do I can give you a list of books. I can give you a list of support groups. So there are resources. That's the beautiful thing about both the state that we live in and the time that we live in, is that there is something that matches everybody's personal need and how they like to process.
And I'm just thinking of these conversations in a different on the age. But, you know, when the child looks at you, they know the second they say, am I dying? You have to answer them honestly, right?
Right. And I mean, hopefully I'm not the first person that's saying that, too. I mean, we are working in tandem with the PAC team at these hospitals and, you know, with oncologists. And, you know, I don't think that it's as taboo of a topic as it was years ago. So, you know, we hope by the time they reach our program that they've had these conversations. And they are difficult conversations.
No question. Yeah.
No question about that. But we really try to have partnerships with these, you know, workers at the hospital that way they can even feel comfortable themselves having these conversations.
Russ, after Stephanie dies, you receive an outpouring of letters from those who knew and loved her. Some of them you include in your book. Did those letters help you through the grieving process?
Oh, yes, very much so. They were very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. And they were instructive. So that whole process helped me. Writing this book helped me. Mm-hmm. And it was gratifying. And I'm still getting letters.
Yeah. And we should tell you use a lot of Stephanie's writings in this. And that must have been an experience for you, too, to go through her journal and, relive all of this.
It was wonderful. And I think one of my learnings was just how mature she was. And I think that the important thing, if there's one message to give to parents that I learned the hard way, it is to listen to your kids and be with your kids. Stephanie was far more mature than I ever realized. In fact, it was only when I put all of her documents together, and it's her book, it isn't mine, and compiled her thinking, her thoughts, her diary entries, it was only then that I realized the depth of her maturity at 18 and 19. So that was a major learning for me.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, once a child dies, what kind of supports are available for families?
Well, they are entitled to 13 months of bereavement support through our program. We have bereavement counselors on staff. You know, if they don't want to opt for the for that, I do refer them out to counselors in the area, depending on their need. There's plenty of support groups out there, the National Alliance for Grieving, you know, Families, and so there's something out there for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So as we were saying, people grieve differently. So and I imagine there's some people say, you know, I don't think I need services, and then maybe a little later they decide they do. That door is always open.
Yeah. And that's very common, actually, is that the first, and Russ, you could probably, you know, relate to this, that you're not immediately ready to process.
Right. Still in shock.
You're still in shock.
Even though you've had that time to think about it.
Absolutely.
Lindsay Coe is the Pediatric Palliative Service Manager through Hope Health. We'll have more information. information about pediatric palliative care programs at our website, capeandislands.org. Russ Lemke's book about his daughter and his experience parenting through her illness is If I Could, I Would, an inspiring story of a young girl who lived life to the fullest. And we'll have more information about Russ and his book at our website. Russ, thanks so much for sharing your story. And it was nice to know Stephanie through the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.